second quarter GDP. It has a two handle. That's a good thing. 2.1 to be exact. Definitely better than most expectations I was viewing. Hey, anybody at the Fed watching these numbers?
All eyes are on the Federal Reserve as the central bank weighs whether it will slash interest rates at the next policy meeting.
There are some sort of newly dovish comments in here. There's a change in the inflation language that kind of suggests that maybe the ECB is going to go to either a higher target or a different kind of target.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, it was a week of political theater in Washington, but we also had central banks meeting this week. Most noteworthy is the ECB hinting at further interest rates could be on the way. It's going to be surprising because in Europe, the ECB's rate is a negative 0.4%. Where are they going with this? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up on the program today, Ari Wald from Oppenheimer will be joining me. He said this market is still heading higher. He's a little bit cautious on the gold market, even though it's breaking out, because he expects the dollar to head higher. And we're going to be talking about some sectors within the S&P that are going to probably be the best place to park money. Also, later on in the program, Ryan Sweet from Moody's Analytics will be joining us. He just did a major paper on the probabilities of a recession. And, of course, joining us on Market Wrap will be Chris Sheridan. And later on, Chris Prytower and I will be talking about, in the big picture, the downside to lower interest rates. I know you're seeing the markets go up to record. Just about every asset class is rising, but there is a downside to lower rates, and we'll be talking about that on the big picture. All of that coming up in today's program.
The S&P 500 and NASDAQ closed at a new record high on Friday after strong second quarter earnings from big names like Alphabet and consumer stocks like McDonald's and Starbucks. Google's parent company, Alphabet, also announced a $25 billion share buyback program, which, along with the earnings beat, sent the giant tech company's stock price up over 9% on Thursday. Two notable exceptions to that on the earnings front were Tesla, which plunged over 13% on Wednesday as it got hit by poor earnings numbers, and news that the co-founder J.B. Straubel was stepping down. Amazon as well reported mixed second quarter results and beat on sales forecasts but missed on earnings estimates. On Friday, the Commerce Department reported that the U.S. economy decelerated from 3.1% in the first quarter to 2.1% in the second. That was actually slightly better than expected, since most economists were lining up for it to come in around 1.8%. In response to the data, President Trump said that the Q2 number was, quote, not bad, considering we have the very heavy weight of the Federal Reserve anchor wrapped around our neck, end quote. And that's in reference to the fact the U.S. Central Bank has been steadily raising rates since 2015. For the past several months, Trump has been calling for the U.S. Central Bank to cut rates and launch more quantitative easing to boost the economy. So that's why he referred to them as an anchor wrapped around our neck. Speaking of the Fed, after Friday's better-than-expected GDP number, the odds of a larger Fed rate cut of 50 basis points, or half of a percent, moved even lower. Most expect that the Fed is now going to be cutting rates by a quarter of a percent. That's 25 basis points when they meet on the 30th and 31st next week. So expect to see a lot of news about that next Tuesday and Wednesday. Manufacturing numbers around the globe showed continued slowing, with the U.S. now at the lowest level since 2009. Outside of the U.S., the numbers were even worse, especially in the Eurozone and particularly in Germany. Strength in the services and consumer side of the global economy is not yet a cause for concern. So right now, the big unknown and debate is whether manufacturing weakness is going to bottom at these levels, or if the services side, including consumers, are going to get dragged down as well. So that's the big debate, and a lot of people watching information on both of those things. One thing that is for sure, central banks around the globe are now either all on hold or easing at this point. So no central banks around the globe are raising rates, we have seen a monetary U-turn, not just by the Fed, but also by other central banks. And the big question with that now is, given the interest rates are already at such low levels and much lower than they were, particularly in the last economic cycle, 2007 and into the 2008 Great Recession, will lower rates from these levels have any effect? Or even more importantly, will it only cause more harm than good? So that's the big question a lot of people are asking. Many big names saying that we shouldn't expect lower Fed rates or lower rates by central banks to have the stimulative effects that they had in prior slowdowns. So that's what makes this current slowdown that we see so important. And obviously, when it comes to that big question, we are going to find out the answer to that in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, it ain't cheap being poor, and I can't take any more of the tickets and the taxes and the fees. I work hard for my pay, and they take it away. Like they don't care, I got a family to feed. They cut my shifts at the mill.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
The weakness in China led to the weakness in Asia, led to the weakness in Europe, particularly Germany, and has impacted U.S. growth, where at least talk about market, the IHS, which will get an updated number tomorrow, their services index is just off the lowest level since mid-2016, before the presidential election. So where this goes from here, we have to see how companies respond in terms of hiring. We have seen, obviously, a moderation in the pace of hiring, even though the level of firing still remains very low because the labor market's tight and employers are holding on to their employees. And if it does lead into a timeout to start in the pace of hiring, well, what does that mean for income growth? What does that then mean for consumer spending? And so on and so forth.
Volatility is back. The stock markets are pivoting, and experts are predicting another recession. How will your retirement weather the storm? Are your investments fortified? Do you have a consistent source of income? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help you answer these questions and plan for the unpredictable. We monitor the markets, interest rates, and the economy so you can focus on doing the things you enjoy most. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Start planning, stop worrying, and make the most of your retirement. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, stock prices continued to head higher this week in anticipation. Next week, the Fed will be cutting interest rates. The question is, will it be a quarter of a point or a half a point? And what will that mean for the stock market? Joining me on the program is Ari Wald from Oppenheimer. Ari, let's begin with your take of the market. As I look at the Dow this week, it's in kind of a sideways chop, but I think that has a lot to do with a couple companies like Boeing on the day we're speaking, and some of the automobile companies aren't doing well. But what do you see with the market here as you look at the major indexes?
Well, the setup is bullish how we read the market. That with the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average making new cycle highs and moving above key resistance levels from 2018, breaking out to the upside, within that, we're also encouraged that what we're seeing internally, specifically that we're seeing a rotation into more cyclical areas of the market, stocks that have been underperformers for much of the last 18 months. And I think this rotation into these cyclicals is going to help propel this next leg of the advance. And this is why we still side positively.
All right. When you've done a study, when the Fed cuts interest rates, a quarter point, a half a point, what happens to the market over the next 12 months? I wonder if you might share that with our listeners.
Yeah, of course. The Fed meeting next Wednesday, July 31st. And we've been receiving a lot of inbounds as far as what are the implications for the equity market should the Fed cut interest rates as they're expected to do, and the Fed funds futures markets are pricing in. And what we found, looking back at the 9 rate cutting cycle, looking at the first Fed rate cut in at least a year, going back to 1971, that when the Fed cut is 25 basis points or less, you typically see higher forward returns in the market. Examples of this, 1989, 1995, 1998. This is typically a sign of what would be called an insurance cut, that the Fed is getting ahead of the situation, and typically the market embraces that and continues to march higher. Conversely, when the Fed cut is 50 basis points or greater, then you have a much greater likelihood of poor performance and elevated risk of a recession. That historically, when the Fed acts aggressively and when they have to cut by at least 50 basis points, it's usually too late at that point. So just looking at the Fed funds futures market, currently pricing in at an 82% probability of 25 points versus only 17.5% of 50 basis points. So I think the market is expecting this insurance cut. And I think we should continue to see this march higher for equity prices too.
So the market's anticipating a quarter of a point. And I agree with you. When you look back historically, if the Fed's cutting a half a point, there's trouble out there and they're probably too late to the party. Let's talk about what's going on within the market internals. And if you look at the sectors, Ari, we've seen breakouts in staples, breakouts in utilities, breakouts in REITs, which to me seems to be more of a yield play. And then you've had, of course, technology still leading. But now you're starting to see a breakout in financials, a breakout in industrials. Let's talk about that and its implications.
You've hit it on the head, Jim, as far as framing what's going on at the sector level and what's driving the market. And for the most part, a lot of these sector rotations have been driven by interest rate. As the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield has moved from 3% at its peak last year to 2% more recently, we've had a very defensive-led rally by sectors like utilities, REITs, consumer staples, higher dividend sectors that tend to act as bond proxies and have more counter-cyclical attributes. Now, you know, in our perspective is that it's actually that the safety trade is stretched and crowded and extended. And I think you do have this potential as interest rates at least have mount a little bit of an oversold move to the upside where some more cyclical areas of the market can start participating. And this is the key point of why we're bullish, that I think rates are finding a floor here at 2%. I think they're due to start to move higher. And I think this is the dry powder for cyclical. Already, as you mentioned, we've seen some better action within financials, within industrials. We're very encouraged by that. We think those are going to be the areas that are going to help lead this next leg of the bull market.
I want to speak a moment for interest rates, because there's always the implication, Ari, when you see an inverted yield curve, that it implies maybe a recession down the road. So on the day you and I are speaking, we've got the 3-month Treasury bill at 2.1, and we've got the 10-year note a little bit less than that. Does any of that concern you?
Yes and no. Yes, an inversion in the curve often precedes, you know, every major market decline is often preceded by an inverted yield curve. I think this does, now that the curve has inverted, it has started the timer as far as when this next recession, you know, is ultimately upon us. But if you look at the when the inversion occurs as a timing indicator, you'll find that historically it's a very poor timing tool. Now, what we found is that either the inversion leads the peak in the S&P by over a year, or two, the inversion lags the peak in the New York Stock Exchange Advanced Decline Line by over a year, meaning that weakness has already been well documented. Now, the Advanced Decline Line is making a new high here, so we're not seeing the trouble, speaking in terms of the breadth of the market. So we think it's going to be the former, where you're going to have this inversion, but it's more likely than not it's going to lead this peak in the S&P by what could be over a year. We've seen it before. That's how the markets are currently setting up. So it does signal more later cycle economic conditions, it is a key difference versus the oversold rates that we had in 2016 that did help lift that rotation towards more cyclical value. I think instead, with that flattening yield curve, I think cyclical growth stocks should continue to outperform in that environment, that the premium gets placed on those higher growth companies in this low growth world that the version is signaling.
So as we look at what's going on in the market, I want to move on to interest rates and then eventually commodities. Right now, as we talked, we have a slight inversion on the short end. There are some that are calling that with the Fed cutting interest rates, that rates in general are going to be heading lower. In other words, they usually don't cut one time. Maybe it's going to be two or three times. I think the market's pricing in two or three cuts. Where do you see interest rates going from where they are now?
Well, when speaking about interest rates, it's very important to discuss the time horizon that we're talking about, you know, especially in terms of the curve, that the Fed is usually going to drive the shorter end of the curve and global growth is going to be more correlated to the long end of the curve. So kind of speaking in terms of the 10-year, which has moved lower, both on expectations of a Fed cut as well as global growth concerns that we're seeing the world over, I think that is at a point where it's overshot to the downside. And I think it is due for a bit of a backup here, whether it materializes with a change in forward Fed guidance. Maybe they won't cut as aggressively as is currently getting priced into the market, looking at further upcoming meetings. Or two, maybe this is a sign that at least global growth has found a little bit of a footing and can start to show some bit of a rebound here over the coming months, the quarters. So from a longer term perspective, we're not expecting significant upside in the 10-year, that we still do think they're going to be anchored by even lower rates overseas. Tough to make the case that the 10-year is going to go meaningfully higher when you have near zero rates in the Eurozone and Asia. But from a near-term basis, I do think, again, we're stretched to the downside and you can get a little bit of a backup. Let's say 2.3% on the 10-year is reasonable to us.
Let's move on to commodities. Gold is broken out. It's holding firm above 1,400. Oil prices are having a little bit of a difficulty staying in the high 50s. What's your take on commodities here in its relation also to the U.S. dollar?
Well, I think what you described there is a very mixed bag when it comes to commodity prices. And I think that's generally going to characterize commodities as a whole for not only over the near term, but potentially longer term as well. And I think the dollar has a lot to do with it. There does tend to be an inverse correlation between the two. Our take is that the dollar is going to grind higher in a very slow manner. I think there's going to be periods where you get some dollar weakness and it's going to provide a tailwind for commodity prices and rising commodity prices. And you're going to get points when the dollar strengthens to a certain degree, and it's going to limit the upside to commodities. And historically, we've seen that before, these very long-term trading ranges for commodity prices. We saw that in the 1950s and the 1960s, as well as the 1980s and 1990s. Interesting, those periods also coincided with secular strength in the S&P 500. So what do stocks like? Is it high commodities, low commodities, stable commodities? And I think that's exactly what we have provided by the dollar. Good for the stock market, less so for those stocks exposed to those commodity prices. As you mentioned, looking within the commodity basket, West Texas has been a little bit the one that's gyrated more in recent months, while gold has shown there's been a much stronger bid for the price of gold. On one hand, I do want to respect the strength in gold. It has broken through some very important long-term resistance levels. But on one hand, it's near-term overbought, I think, could be finding a bit of a near-term ceiling. And again, I just don't think we're going to have that big decline in the dollar to create that sustainable move in gold like we saw from 2001 to 2011 when you had a nearly 50% haircut in the U.S. dollar. So trade it higher, raise your stops, but keep your expectations limited. I don't expect it's going to be the same type of move in gold like we saw last decade.
Well, you know, the one thing that has been driven the dollar and that still exists, a stronger U.S. economy and higher interest rates. And even though you and I are talking about lower interest rates here, I mean, our bond yields on treasuries look like junk bonds if you go over across the pond and look at Europe or what's going on in Asia, for example, Japanese bonds or even German bonds, which have negative interest rates.
That's exactly right. And I think it's really all the same trade. If you're worried about the signals from the bond market, you have to look overseas. It's really the global growth concerns from what's going on outside of the U.S. So for that frames our U.S. over world recommendation. That frames our growth over value recommendation. At the same time, I think the S&P and the U.S. stock market is also benefiting due to a higher composition of the technology sector and those higher growth companies. And of course, it leads to our recommendation for tech, where we're really, it's the sector of the market that's showing the broadest amount of strength, both across industries as well as capitalizations. To me, it's all the same trade. It's what you're seeing in the bond market that's arguing for US over world. It's arguing for growth over value, and it's arguing for continued leadership by the technology sector. If we're in a secular bull market, speaking in terms of the S&P 500, we still think that this is the prime candidate to lead those gains over the coming quarters to years.
I guess the next question and final one, Ari, given where the markets are now, breaking out new record levels, Fed getting ready to cut interest rates probably more than just once, where would you be positioning money at this point?
Our recommendation to investors is that exposure to equities is still warranted. And it's a very high conviction idea right here that with the market breaking out to the upside, we think this is a point where even more cyclical issues start to outperform. So we would be recommending to invest within equities and even the more cyclical parts of the equity market as well. Now, tech for the long run, as much as tech has run up a bit over the near term, I think you stick with it. And if you're looking for new money ideas, I'd point you into sectors like industrials and select parts of financials. We also like consumer services, medical devices, and the high growth retailers as well. So in summation, we would tell the listeners and our clients to be buying stocks, specifically more cyclical growth stocks.
As we close, if our listeners would like to follow you, how could they do so?
Well, they can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Ari Wald.
All right, Ari, thanks so much and have yourself a great weekend.
Take care, Jim. You too. Bye now.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
The militaries of the future will have large quantities of smaller systems, including swarms of autonomous machines that distribute sensing and moving and shooting communications away from vulnerable single points of failure. They'll be cheap and expendable, and really the quality of a military's software may determine who wins and loses.
One of the big events in 2019 was a 180-degree pivot by the Fed. Last year, the Fed raised interest rates 4 times, and it was anticipated they would raise them 3 times this year. Now they're talking about cutting interest rates as soon as the end of this month. What does this mean? Are we in risk of a recession? Joining us on the program is Ryan Sweet from Moody's Analytics. Ryan, before we get into recession probabilities, I want to talk about some of the recent data. One of the things that's a little bit of concern, business investment has been poor. But on the other hand, 2/3 of the economy is driven by consumers and retail sales has been doing pretty good. We have an uptick in the Philly Fed. So based on recent data, what are things looking like for you guys as we go forward in the second half of the year in terms of economic growth?
Yeah, overall, I mean, we've been getting a lot of mixed messages on the state of the economy. As you mentioned, some of the survey-based data, so the Philly Fed's survey of manufacturers, that dropped sharply a couple months ago. It's bounced back. A lot of that is attributed to the recent escalation in the trade tensions in early May, threats of putting tariffs on Mexico. And I think that really weighed heavily on manufacturer sentiment. Manufacturing is in a slump, probably one of the weakest parts of the economy. You could probably argue that manufacturing is in a little bit of a recession. We've seen industrial production fall for 2 consecutive quarters. The ISM manufacturing surveys drop. Overall, manufacturers are just not in a very upbeat mood. the remedy to that is resolving these trade tensions. But, you know, there's other factors weighing on manufacturing, a slower global economy, past appreciation in the U.S. dollar. You know, that's just weighing manufacturing output, manufacturing sentiment. And also another weak spot, as you alluded to, is business investment. You know, now, you know, kind of coming off a sugar high in 2018, business investment got a little bit of a boost from the tax legislation. So we're just settling down in a little bit more sustainable pace of growth. And it shouldn't be too surprising that investment's weakening. Profit growth is moderating. I think that's weighing on investment as well. But most importantly, as the U.S. economy goes, it's the consumer. And the consumer's got plenty of tailwinds. Everything's going pretty well for the consumer. Labor market's tight. Wage growth's picking up. Inflation's low. Interest rates are low. The stock market's appreciating. House prices are rising. As long as the consumer hangs in there, as long as the job market hangs in there, I think the risks of a recession are pretty low in the immediate future.
Ryan, one of the surprising stories this year is the weakness in business investment. It was thought with the economic stimulus, the tax bill, slashing corporate tax rates from 35 to 21%, this would spur investment beyond 1 year. But it looks like, you know, we got a little bit of that last year, but it's on stall. Has that surprised many people that this didn't continue? And do you think that's a reflection of global trade tensions, that businesses just don't feel confident given these back and forth tariffs? And first it was China, then it could have been Mexico, then it was Europe. Is that what is perhaps causing businesses to hesitate?
I think it's a big factor. I mean, if you look at various measures of business confidence, we have a weekly business confidence measure, and that's, you know, dropped sharply since, you know, the trade tensions really began in early 2018, late 2017. Businesses are not overly optimistic. They're concerned. Businesses like certainty, but there's a lot of policy uncertainty. And most of it can be traced back to these trade tensions between the U.S. and also threats to put tariffs on Europe, Mexico. It makes it very difficult for businesses to plan well ahead. And also these tariffs, you know, they're disrupting the supply chain, causing issues with businesses sourcing materials. So I don't think it's too surprising that you've seen businesses hunker down on both production and investment. You know, outside of tariffs and sentiment, I don't think many economists are surprised that the tax legislation didn't provide a more lasting boost to business investment. If you look historically, there's not a very strong relationship, if even if there's one at all, between the corporate tax rate and capital spending. So this was just more, the tax legislation last year was just kind of a shot in the arm to the economy, boosted consumer spending, boosted investment. But all of that was just temporary. It didn't, the tax legislation didn't alter the economy's potential growth rate. You know, that's typically a function of productivity growth and labor force growth. Overall, you know, this was just more of a one-time shot, and we're now just settling back into a more sustainable pace of growth. And I think the concern is, you know, a slowing economy isn't a recession. You know, we weren't going to be able to duplicate the 3% GDP growth that we got last year in 2019 and 2020. So we're just settling down into, you know, kind of what we got pre-fiscal stimulus for most of this expansion.
I want to talk about something you recently wrote, and that is what could trigger a recession in 2020. Now, in the past, we've seen things like the asset bubble. Think of the bursting of the tech bubble, an overheating economy, which usually leads to Fed tightening. There's an old saw on Wall Street, economic recoveries don't die of old age. The Fed killed every single one of them. Now we have the Fed talking about lowering interest rates. Now you talk about some of the things that have led to recessions in the past, inventory imbalances, oil supply shocks. We can think of 2008 when the price of oil got to 150, overheating, a policy error, financial balances, and fiscal tightening. So given all of these possibilities right now, at least in your piece, you don't see any one of them really threatening the economy at the moment.
You're right. And they don't seem overly threatening currently. I mean, it doesn't mean that these things couldn't change quickly. But, you know, right now, the economy's fundamentals are fine. There's no indication that the economy is overheating. We have inflation below the Fed's 2% target. Nominal wage growth, if you look at the ECI for private workers, is right around 3%, which is exactly where it should be. You know, the job market's tight, but there's no indication that that's overheating either. And I think the most encouraging thing is that, you know, the Fed, you know, they're not tightening interest rates until they break something anymore. You know, they've responded to the heightened downside risk to the U.S. economy, the uncertainties in their forecast for growth and inflation, the recent inversion in the yield curve, I think kind of may have spooked some people on the Fed. And they're responding. They're probably going to cut interest rates later this month. So the Fed's not going to be the reason why this expansion dies. there's a lot of talk of a recession 2020. If you look at various measures of business sentiment, you know, the Duke CFO confidence survey, a lot of CEOs are predicting a recession in 2020. Economists are generally pinpointing 2020 as the likelihood of a next downturn. An economist's track record in predicting recessions is pretty terrible. So the fact that a lot of economists are expecting a recession in 2020 means it's not going to happen. But to get one next year, an event would have to occur where it has significant economic costs, but also affects the collective psyche. So an example would be if the Trump administration continues to escalate the trade tensions, eventually businesses will begin to cut workers. That will push the unemployment rate higher. And then that has a psychological impact. Even if the unemployment rate is rising from a low level, you know, consumers are going to take notice, then they hunker down, and that's a recipe for a recession. But unless we shoot ourselves in the foot with, you know, these trade tensions, the concerns about a recession in 2020 seem a little bit premature to me.
You know, it seems to me that one impact that the Fed was looking at is what happened in the stock market in the fourth quarter, where you had basically almost a 20% correction in the market. And Ryan, you know, consumers, whether they're invested in stocks or not, take notice. When you see that the stock market's down 20%, it starts to frighten people. It frightens business CEOs. It frightens investors and consumers. Like, everybody wakes up and says, wow, maybe there's something wrong here. So if you talk about an event, another severe correction as we had in the fourth quarter, is that a possibility that could trigger a possible recession?
It could. And where we are in the business cycle and in the state of the economy is very important when we, you know, hit these corrections in the stock market. And, you know, it's important to remember that corrections, they're normal. They happen roughly once every 2 years on average since, like, roughly the 1970s. But when the economy is growing above its potential growth rate, we can absorb these hiccups in the stock market reasonably well. The concern would be if the economy is growing steadily below its potential growth rate, which, you know, from a GDP perspective, that's 1.5-2%. So if we're growing towards the low end of that range and we get a big stock market correction, then that, yes, could force the economy close to a recession because, like you mentioned, it's going to affect confidence. Consumers, it's one of their barometers for the state of the economy, is, you know, the stock market, because they see it every day in the newspaper, when they turn on TV. What the stock market did that day is pretty clear. But the stock market isn't the economy. So, you know, if we get a 10% correction here and there, it's not going to push us into a recession because the economy is less sensitive to the stock market than, you know, what the press allude to.
I want to talk about another factor that people cite as a possible reason for a recession, and that's the yield curve. Although I don't know how valid that is when you have central banks intervening in the market. But right now, on the day you and I are talking, the yield on a 3-month Treasury bill is higher than a 10-year note or a 7-year note or a 5-year note.
It is. And, you know, the inversion in the yield curve has garnered a lot of attention. And you bring up a very good point about global quantitative easing. And that's really depressed long-term rates. So it sounds like you're not buying the yield curve. And for a long time, I felt like I was an island by myself. And, you know, I really wasn't too concerned about the recent inversion in the yield curve because the 10-year Treasury yield is really no longer a risk-free rate. And the other thing to keep in mind with the yield curve is there's a strong correlation between an inversion in the yield curve and recessions. Typically, when the 10-year yield and the 3-month invert, a recession follows 12 to 13 months afterwards. But that correlation isn't causation. An inversion in the yield curve doesn't cause recessions. It usually just reflects the conditions that ultimately lead to a recession. And if you go back to the traditional causes of recessions that we discussed earlier, none of them are overly threatening right now. So it's going to have to be, you know, some other exogenous shock that, you know, triggers this recession. Because given when the yield curve inverted this year, that would imply a recession sometime in mid-2020. And to get that, you know, something's going to have to go terribly wrong pretty soon to force the economy into a recession.
You know, the other thing that is concerning, and maybe the Fed's concerned about this as well, and that is we have higher levels of debt today. If you look at corporate debt, and even it's not just corporate debt, Ryan, it's also the composition. Almost 50% of corporate debt is triple B, which is just one notch above junk, and then about another quarter is junk bonds. So when you have low quality debt and a lot of it, is that a possible risk for a recession? In other words, some kind of event happens, yield spreads widen, you take companies that may not be able to roll over debt. As you point out, maybe there's not a single event, but perhaps it's a perfect storm. It's a combination of events that could possibly lead to a recession.
I think you're spot on. And I maintain this risk matrix that shows the likelihood of an event and also the economic impact. And pretty high up on there is corporate debt. It's up there along with Brexit and an escalation in, you know, the U.S. trade tensions. So if all these kind of occur right around the same time, a no deal Brexit, the Trump administration pushes forward with additional tariffs on China, there's some strains in corporate debt, then that would be enough to push us into a recession. The odds of all three of those kind of coming together at the same time are still pretty low. But I do agree that corporate debt is a concern, particularly the leveraged loan market. But the fact that the Fed's, you know, easing monetary policy, the odds of a substantial increase in interest rates, it's pretty low. Also, a lot of the corporate debt's fixed. So there may be less vulnerability to higher interest rates than, you know, some are concerned about. And then when you look at the consumer side, the household balance sheets are in pretty good shape. A lot of concern about credit card debt. It's over $1 trillion. That makes great headlines. But what matters for the consumer are monthly debt payments. And if you look at the Fed's debt service ratio, financial obligations ratios, they're all among the lowest since the 1980s, implying that, you know, consumers aren't having a hard time meeting their monthly obligations. And now, of course, this is on aggregate. You know, there are some people, a lot of people that are struggle from paycheck to paycheck, but in aggregate terms, household debt isn't, you know, overly threatening right now.
So at least for the moment, it doesn't look likely a recession for 2020. But as you point out, if we get a combination of events, maybe that's what triggers it. Ryan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you guys at Moody's do probably one of the most complete jobs I've ever seen on economics. You cover not only just economics here, internationally, in a lot of the main indicators with some great analysis. How could they find out more about your firm?
Yeah, all our research is published on our economy.com website. We cover 300 economic indicators globally, and we provide daily commentary on financial markets and global economic development. So everything's available on economy.com.
All right. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Incoming information since the last Governing Council meeting in early June indicates that while further employment gains and increasing wages continue to underpin the resilience of the economy, softening global growth dynamics and weak international trade are still weighing on the euro area outlook. Moreover, the prolonged presence of uncertainties related to geopolitical factors, the rising threat of protectionism and vulnerabilities in emerging markets is dampening economic sentiment, notably in the manufacturing sector. In this environment, inflationary pressures remain muted, and indicators of inflation expectations have declined. Therefore, a significant degree of monetary stimulus continues to be necessary to ensure that financial conditions remain very favorable and support the euro area expansion. The ongoing build-up of domestic price pressures and thus headline inflation developments over the medium term.
So that was the ECB's Mario Draghi, who hinted that rate cuts and stimulus are also coming to Europe, and that sent the euro down this week. Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Prytower. This is The Big Picture. Well, the stock markets, they've been moving higher on anticipated rate cuts coming from the Fed, and that could come as soon as next week. But right now, the futures markets are anticipating a quarter point cut next week with close to an 80% probability of a quarter point cut. Probabilities for half a point cut have receded to only a 21% probability. Now, since some of the economic news has been better than expected and stock indexes have headed into record territory, the need for a major cut has lessened. So as we've seen, financial markets respond that there is a downside to these rate cuts, and that's the subject of today's Big Picture.
Well, Chris, let's begin with the markets. Obviously, the markets are loving the Fed easing cycle as it's very supportive of the stock market. Indeed, when you look at the yield on Treasury bonds, which have dropped to around 2%, yields on some of the stock market sectors are offering yields that are much higher. And that's one reason we've seen within the S&P 500 sectors like utilities, staples,
rates hit record levels in a world where almost a third, think about this, a third of sovereign debt is negative, yields on some stocks are 2 to 3 times higher on what you can earn on treasuries. Not to mention that the highest bond yields globally in the developed world are here in the U.S. Now, there's a scramble to find yields as they are heading lower, and in many cases, they are negative. So this is probably one reason why the U.S. dollar and our bond markets are doing much better than the global financial markets. Put it this way, we're the best game in town. As our economy is stronger, our bond yields are higher, which is why Ari Wald mentioned earlier in the program, it's one reason the U.S. dollar is probably likely to grind higher.
And Jim, we've discussed on this program that the global easing cycle is helping really just about every asset class. Stocks are hitting new records, bond prices are heading higher as yields fall, even commodities from gold to oil, even now it looks like copper is doing well. So what's not to like about lower yields?
You know, on the surface, it all sounds good. Asset prices are rising. Who doesn't want to see that? And here's the good thing about it. As asset prices rise, it makes the debt levels in the economy look much better. Obviously, if you've got assets that keep rising, you take those assets against your debt looks much more manageable. The problem we're going to have, and I don't know when they hit the economy, is when these debt levels get so high, they are not serviceable. I mean, let's talk about what happened this week. The budget deal just reached in Congress expands government spending and ends the era of spending restraints that were put way back in place in the 2011 Budget Control Act, which placed limits on spending for each fiscal year. There were automatic spending cuts known as the sequester that would go into effect if spending went beyond the agreed limits. That just came to an end this week with this new budget deal that does away with all spending restraints put in place a decade ago to tame the deficits. You can recall back in the years 2009, we were coming out of a recession, a financial crisis, the Fed, the government, and you, the taxpayer, were bailing out the financial system. We were running, I think it was 2010, the budget deficit got to $1.6 trillion. Well, it was announced by the White House this week that this year's fiscal deficit will be $1 trillion, and that the U.S. would be experiencing $1 trillion deficits every year going forward. All of this at a time when the economy is still growing at 2%. And here's what happens. This raises the question, what will the deficits look like when the economy enters a recession? In a recession, people lose their jobs, unemployment goes up, tax revenues fall, and the deficits explode as they did between 2008 and 2010. So that raises the question, what will they do to counter that? So this is what we're going to be talking about in the future, and you're going to hear more about it. MMT is upon us, as neither party, Republican or Democrat, is interested in any fiscal discipline with more entitlements from guaranteed income, Medicare for all, to free college is being promised. All of these promises being made at a time when the Social Security trustees warn that both Social Security and Medicare are heading for a funding crisis in the next decade. Another issue being raised here by both fiscal and monetary policy is that it seems that in order to prevent a slowdown or a recession, the economy is in constant need of stimulus. Take, for example, last year's $1.5 trillion tax cut, $300 billion of appropriations for additional spending. Well, that's coming to an end. Voila, what do we have in the new budget deal? Another $300 billion of additional fiscal spending, bringing this year's deficit, which ends in September fiscal year, to over $1 trillion as the nation's national debt heads to over $23 trillion.
Well, at least for the moment, the markets seem to like the new fiscal and monetary stimulus. But outside a future debt crisis, Jim, what are the other side effects that you see?
Well, let's talk about what happens when interest rates fall or they're lowered and maybe heading zero bound. Let's begin with the banking sector. Part of the profits that banks earn on lending, it's not just profits on the spread between what they pay you, the depositor, and then what they charge you, the borrower. But banks earn a lot of profits on lending to the housing market. And part of that is mortgage servicing business. Now, mortgage servicing involves collecting payments, performing administration duties on home loans. As rates head lower, as they're doing now, they can fuel mortgage making, but they also hurt the other side of the business, the value of servicing rights. And recent earnings that we've seen coming from the major banks, they disclose steep declines in the value of their servicing assets. And let's go to another market. In Europe, matters are actually much worse as banks there with negative rates have to pay the ECB to park reserves at the central bank. Now, in the U.S., by comparison, the U.S., the Fed pays interest on reserves. Currently, the ECB rate is a negative 0.4%. Why that's important is this week, the meeting with Draghi, hinting at further rate cuts, meaning that negative rates are actually going to get bigger in Europe. So they're already hinting that they're going to be cutting rates. And look, they're at negative right now. He also hinted at restarting bond purchases, in other words, QE, with the possibility of potential new purchases that go well beyond government bonds. They're going to start running out of them. Perhaps a helicopter drop. There's talk of paying banks to lend money to get the credit engines flowing again. Great business to be in. Can you imagine the government giving you money? If you have a business, they're going to give it to you free and you loan it out to other people and make money. But they're underestimating the damage done to the economy by keeping interest rates to zero. The result is low rates are hurting the banking system, insurance companies, and pension systems. Remember, the hubs of financing are banks, insurance companies. They're the ones that spur credit. They make loans. What is needed is stimulation and demand for capital, not to further lower the cost of debt. It's one reason outside of Germany, the European economy has been so moribund, with unemployment rates as high or higher than 10%. In fact, youth unemployment is well over 10% in Europe. So what we've got over Europe is high taxes, excess regulation, negative interest rates, which are strangling the European economies. And here's the risk. Central banks now face by cutting interest rates when economies are still growing is that they will have no firepower if the economy actually turns down and goes into a recession. What are they going to do when interest rates are zero? And the one good thing, I guess, and this is something I have not seen up until recently in my four decades in the business. Normally, you get economic stimulus and you get monetary stimulus when the economy is in a recession. To bring the economy out of a recession, the Fed lowers interest rates and government steps up spending to re-stimulate the economy. Well, we're not in a recession and we got a massive tax cut. And now, with the economy still growing at 2%, the central bank, the Fed, and the ECB are going to embark on a monetary easing cycle. The question is, what do they do after they fired all of their bullets before a recession happens?
Okay, well, this brings me back to the issue that you and even Ryan Sweet discussed earlier, and that's the probability of a recession next year. And there are many reasons that cause a recession. We talk about some of these on the program from time to time. There are inventory imbalances, oil supply shocks, overheating economy. Sometimes there's monetary policy error, financial imbalances, even fiscal tightening can cause a recession. But none of these are in place right now. Yet there are some pretty smart people out there like Ray Dalio of Bridgewater, Kyle Bass, and there are others that see a possible recession next year. In fact, Jim, Kyle Bass, he's betting that 10-year yields drop below 1% by next year. Do you think that could happen?
Well, it's one reason Moody's is saying for a recession to occur because none of the things you just mentioned are in place right now. So it would have to be triggered by an event that has, let's say, significant economic costs. It hits the collective psyche. Think of major events like the bankruptcy of Lehman, 9/11, things like that. It causes businesses to cut hiring. They increase layoffs. That pushes the unemployment higher. all of this implies it would most likely have to be, I would say, another financial crisis of, a major financial institution, a giant hedge fund like Long-Term Capital Management, or let's say a major company goes under and triggers a run on money, similar to what almost occurred in the first weeks of 2016 when credit spreads blew out. The Fed raised interest rates for the first time in December 2015. And I don't know if many listeners remember, but in the first 6 weeks of 2016, credit spreads were just blown away. There was difficulty, liquidation of bonds, and the stock market fell 6 weeks in a row, which was one reason the Fed did not raise interest rates until December of 2016, even though they planned to raise several times. And of course, it was also an election year. But we saw a lot of companies back in 2016, especially in the oil patch. Remember, oil got down to $26 a barrel, and a lot of those smaller companies in the shale patch actually went bankrupt.
Okay, so given the fact that more monetary stimulus is coming as soon as next week, what does this mean for investors?
You know, for stock investors, it means the markets are probably likely to head higher, as Ari Wald was talking about. How much higher the market was 6 months and 12 months after a first rate cut. But it means we're back to a TINA market. In other words, there is no alternative to stocks. Right now and throughout most of the year, individual investors, here's what I found surprising. They've been pouring money, not into stocks as you would suspect, but actually into bond funds. They've been piling into bond funds as stock indexes have been hitting one record after another. Now, according to Bank of America Merrill Lynch, $12.1 billion of inflows went into bond funds last week, bringing the total year-to-date to $254 billion. Now, let me put that in perspective. At present pace, the projection for inflows this year are expected to approach nearly $500 billion, a figure not seen since the financial crisis back in 2008. Chris, and we're not in a financial crisis. And even more perspective, in the last 10 years, $1.7 trillion has gone into bond funds. And we're talking just this year, $500 billion. The figure will approach $500 billion in a single year. Not even through, even though stock indexes are hitting records, surprisingly, the money is flowing out of stock funds. About $46 billion this year has come out of stocks versus $254 billion into bond funds and bond ETFs. Lower interest rates, the influx of money into bond funds, and this is what it's going to mean to you, the investor. Bond funds are going to be lowering their dividends as the bonds they buy will be paying lower interest, causing them to lower their monthly distributions. We saw a lot of this happen after the financial crisis. So as rates head lower, investors are going to need to be prepared to see their income from investments fall. So believe it or not, the best yields can be found in stocks right now, which is one reason why, as Ari and I were talking about, you've seen sectors within the S&P, utilities, staples, and REITs do as well as this year. And there are even greater yields to be found in the energy sector, which is currently out of favor on Wall Street. Beaten down tech stocks and even industrial stocks, along with healthcare, which has been falling due to prospects of socialized medicine. Now, here's the one downside we haven't discussed here, is what lower rates mean to investors, retirees, pension funds, and insurance companies. The majority of pension funds, especially at the state level, are underfunded, including my own state of California, which is underfunded by several hundred billion dollars. Most pension funds, including California, are assuming a 7% rate of return to fund their obligations. For retirees or savers, lower interest rates means less money to spend and a lower standard of living. So low or zero interest rates can also have lower economic growth as individuals earn less on their savings and have less to spend. This particularly hits retirees the hardest.
So even though there really are no signs of recession right now, or even a financial crisis, we still see that rates are heading lower. Now, those rates may or may not stimulate the economy, but they are surely stimulating the asset markets, and it's making cash an unattractive asset.
You think about that mixture, if returns are going to be lower, then savings rates have to be higher, or the amount of risk investors are willing to take in their portfolios has to go up. But certainly the level of expected returns from both stocks and bonds is going to a lower level. And that's a realization I think many investors have slowly, slightly come around to.
Right.
So as we conclude here, we can say that lower rates can actually do as much harm as good. They hurt bank servicing profits. They harm savers in depriving them of returns. They also hurt pension funding with lower returns. And also they may deprive central banks of options should the economy turn down. But for now, it does look like lower rates are stimulating asset returns.
Well, next week will be a big week, Chris. We have the Fed meeting where it's widely anticipated, at least the futures market has a probability, a little over 80%, that the Fed will be cutting interest rates a quarter of a point. What's going to be important in that meeting is not just the quarter point rate cut, if that happens, but what they're saying about the future. In other words, is this the first of many more rate cuts to come in the future? They meet again in September. So there will be three more meetings after that. Will they be cutting rates further? We'll be looking at that. We're halfway through the earnings season. And of course, we need to follow the economic numbers. Will the economy continue to grow? You know, some are saying maybe what we get is a growth recession. So the economy is still growing, but at a lower rate. In the meantime, we'll be here to talk about it, as I hope you will. On behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense NewsHour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.